Good evening. It's good to be with you all this evening.
Back stuck with me for the next couple of weeks. We're going to pick up where I left off, talking about faith, science, and knowledge. We really rushed through the back end of that lesson, so I want to spend some more time on that tonight. And then once we finish that, assuming we finish that, I want to just look at some scriptures that give some surprising level of insight into the kind of attitudes and viewpoints that we have today and how relevant they are. And we'll just get as far through those as we can. Last time that I taught, to kind of catch up on or recap, we talked about categories of faith or how we acquire our faith. And we might acquire something firsthand, we might hear it from someone else, there might be some combination of evidence and reasoning to come to a conclusion that we have some confidence in. But that faith gets applied to, faith is by definition something that we don't see or know firsthand. And so it gets applied to things that are maybe distantly removed from us by space, distance, by time, or maybe it's something in the future. We believe something will happen based on things that we know or believe now. We develop faith through testimony, through observing the evidence, through reasoning. For historical types of faith or things that are related to our faith and what has happened in the past, that has to be based on things that aren't here now. If it's an event that happened before, we can know what conditions come into play right now, but we don't know directly what happened in the past because we can't travel back in time. So we look at testimony. We look at how do people behave? Is it reasonable that that happened in the past? Is it reasonable that natural elements would have supported some conclusion about some historical natural event in the past? Science is a systematic study. It is not just here are facts and that is science. Science is looking at facts and drawing conclusions from them. Through observing the physical and natural world, using experiments, testing theories. Another name for it is natural philosophy. And really, that's a very key part that we need to understand is that science is not, it is philosophy, because it looks at some information, and then you think about that information through certain ways. It might be certain methods, the scientific method, but it has certain assumptions and it has certain viewpoints as to how we can use that information to draw conclusions, and that's philosophy. We talked about how science works, and the scientific method is kind of the classic sense, and this is what's called, this is useful for what's called operational sciences. So physics, chemistry, biology, things that we can see happening now, and we can do them again, and we can do them again, that's operational. It's the current things. How do things work right now? But that doesn't work for things that happened in the past. And so you have to use different processes, although some of the first ones can come into play to inform our understanding of what might have happened in the past. But it's called abductive reasoning or inference to the best explanation. What is the most reasonable conclusion? Because we can't repeat creation. We can't repeat historical events. We can have another event that is maybe the same, but it's not that event. But this is useful for historical sciences, which includes, obviously, origins studies of whether it's evolution or alternatives to that, archaeology, and forensics. Forensics is a historical science, whether that's in the distant past or the very recent past. We'll be fielding some questions or asking some questions tonight, but I do want to move quickly, so I'm going to be looking for answers quickly, or I'll move on and answer it myself. Does anybody know what this person is looking at, just in kind of a generic sense? Auger plates, is that what I heard? Okay, so this is a growth medium called auger, A-G-A-R, and you put stuff, a liquid on it or something, if you want to see something will grow there, some bacteria or some fungus or whatever. And so it's a little hard to see on this display, but there's a lot in this one, there's less in this and this one, and so forth, until this one. It's hard to tell if there's any at all stuff growing. And the reason you have something like that is called titration. You take this sample and you're like, does this chemical kill this germ? That's kind of a typical kind of question you might ask. Or does this medicine kill these good cells in the body? This is an important question to ask. Before you start putting it into someone's body, you'll get some tissue and see, does this chemical or does this medicine damage that tissue? Is it able to continue to reproduce the way it normally would? And so you take it and you dilute it tenfold, you dilute it tenfold, you dilute it tenfold, and so forth until you don't get any growth, or you have the evidence that there's nothing there. So if that's the way that we're going to approach it, does this thing stop the cell from reproducing? What are some assumptions? I'm going to take a cell, and we're going to see if it can grow. We're going to see if something can inhibit that growth, whether that's desired or not. What are some assumptions that go into that, do you think?
You're assuming everything else is constant, but this is the only thing you're shooting.
Okay. To draw a conclusion like this, if you're saying, does the presence of this medicine change something, you really need to know if anything else is being introduced there, or maybe that other thing is the cause of the change. So your assumption is, and so the scientists really try to control this, that nothing else is different but this one thing, and that's called a variable. You vary one thing and one thing only, and if that changes something, then it's a reasonable conclusion that, what? If you vary one thing and it changes something, okay, there's a probably a causal relationship, maybe just a correlation relationship, but to determine if it's a cause or correlation, you might try a different variable and see, does it still have that same effect? You might try it in a different order, try to narrow that down. Okay, so that one assumption, that nothing else is changing, or no, there are no other variables present that are producing this effect. What else? We're putting a cell into something, you want to see if it's still alive or is growing at the end of it. There's some really fundamental assumption to start that off. The cell is what at the beginning? Alive. Okay, so if we put a cell into this medium and you get no growth with the medicine, you might say, oh no, this medicine is very detrimental to the cell's health. What scientists will do is they'll have another set that has the same, we can't use the same cell, but maybe a group of cells. And really, we're talking about millions of cells, not one and two, but many, many cells. But you take this group of cells and you split some, you put them with the medicine, you take the others, put them in a situation that you know always grows them. You don't put the medicine there. If those die, and they shouldn't die, then maybe you have some bad cells to start with. So they call it a control group. The assumption is that always works, and it should work this time. There's an assumption that if something always works, it should continue to always work. That's taken by faith alone. It's a very strong basis for that faith, but no one, unless someone with authority, tells us this is how things work, and that person absolutely knows and has not just learned it from someone else. We're just assuming that's how they work. So this uniformitarian assumption is very essential to the practice of science. Otherwise, you can't run experiments and learn anything meaningful from it. If you have cells showing up, there's another assumption, which is they come from the cell that you put in. And this gets to another point about faith and faith in science, how faith is involved in science, which is that life does not just spontaneously show up, which is an interesting essential conclusion or essential foundation to experiments like this and is contrary to an evolutionary viewpoint of the spontaneous generation of life. But even evolutionists would rarely, if ever, say life spontaneously exists in high complexity. You don't suddenly have a cell from nothing. They would say it came from something simpler and so on, trace it back. There was a famous scientist who ran experiments where he proved that or demonstrated that life does not spontaneously come from non-life. Why? Pasteur. So we get pasteurization because that was named after him because he had a process to kill all of the microbial life in something, and that can help preserve foods or liquids, milk, whatever. But there's an underlying assumption that if you kill everything in that jug of milk, that things won't just start growing. If you've killed everything, and he ran experiments to isolate something. The really primitive version of this was you have meat in a jar that's open. You have meat in a jar that is covered with cloth. You have meat in a jar that's sealed up more. And do larvae, fly larvae, just pop up from meat? No, they don't. Meat does not produce larvae. It's the flies who land on it, and then they lay their eggs, and it turns into larvae. So experiments like that are the basis for this. And you don't go back and rerun Pasteur's experiments every time you do this. You assume that in your control, if there is no intentional life put in there, you should not see any coming out. And if you do see some, then this experiment is contaminated. You place faith in all these conclusions, all this previous work from other scientists when you're running your experiments. And maybe you've run them at some point in high school or college as a practice, but you don't really have to because it's a reliable source and you can count on that, but it is faith. A good practice, I guess, to develop this skill set, and it's a skill or a habit. When you're talking with someone who feels like they are not operating on the basis of faith, they're operating on the basis of fact and knowledge, but you, with your religion, are operating on faith, probably blind faith, baseless faith, is to look for the faith in what they do, in what the conclusions they draw. So somebody just give me an example of something you think you know about the natural world. Anything? Gravity. What do you think you know about gravity?
Yes, and that it keeps us where we are right now, not floating in the air.
Okay, so gravity attracts two bodies. We could expand that and say the mass of two bodies draws them together. We don't understand that, but we know that it happens, and we can count on it, okay? How did you come to that knowledge? Okay, so you have one basis for that knowledge, which is someone telling you that gravity is what keeps you down, not an upward motion of the earth, which you can read about that online. That there isn't gravity, it's just we're getting pushed down because the earth is accelerating towards us, probably a flat-shaped earth. And that's why we stay on it, is because of this motion. How do you know that it's one and not the other? Have you seen the sphere of the earth with your own eyes? I mean, we could kind of go, do we know that the earth is round or flat? How do we come to that conclusion? So there are some really fundamental assumptions in that. So one of the sources is we were taught it, and that's very common for, I mean, it's everybody,
right? So we have faith because we were taught things. Can you also, if somebody told you that every fifth year gravity reverses, how would you, would it would be difficult to study that? No, it wouldn't. It would, you know, it'd take a little while. You'd have to wait, which is the fifth year. It could be a little nerve-wracking. Or you probably wouldn't have to wait for the fifth year. Would you? Like, you could figure out, okay, if it's going to happen in 5 years and I missed the last one, I'm just getting into kindergarten and I just missed the last one, you would expect to see some residual evidence of gravity having reversed 5 years ago when you were just before you were born. Like buildings torn up and oh, I don't know, flipped over, torn apart. Just, you know, a lot of people not here. So someone can make that assertion, but you have not, you don't need someone to tell you that gravity doesn't reverse every 5 years. You can see that from the evidence. But you could also say, no, that is absolutely true, but there are some mitigating theories about why we don't have complete chaos, but it is still true that it reverses every 5 years. So there's faith in all these things. Okay, another example, something you feel like you know about the natural world. All right, so we have expert testimony that water runs downhill. How did you come to that conclusion? Okay. Oh, yes, but there are some exceptions. Okay. Why do you have confidence in the knowledge that water runs downhill?
Because of calculations that I've done and observations that I've made.
Not to put you on the spot, but did the calculations accurately predict the baby?
Sometimes. And you know what I was taught.
And we are all counting
on that from all of our civil engineers to accurately understand not just that water runs downhill, but at what rate does it run downhill? And how much is it retained? And what kind of interaction does it have with surfaces? Sorry to drive it and get into your lane of engineering, but like there's so much more that goes into that, oversimplified, but.
Water runs downhill, but it's not because it's downhill. It's because of gravity. It's because of pressure. In you know which case it could actually run uphill. You know it can run up grade, but it's not necessarily running up grade. You know it's because of pressure and other things. But you know from the initial education, yes, water runs downhill. But when you get more information, and you study more, and you do more experiments, you realize that it's not just because of downhill. So even though those facts and those things are true, it's not true in every situation. And, you know, learning when that happens and when it doesn't is something you find out later. But anyway.
And you did, I'm sure you did some of those experiments in labs in school. But not every experiment for every calculation that you trust and that we are trusting you to do accurately. And you know, and that goes for scientists, engineers, physicians, you know, so many things that we take for granted that bridges will stay up when we drive across them, that buildings will not collapse on our heads, that medicine will do what it usually does, and when it doesn't, or if it's questionable, we get pretty nervous about it. And the less faith we have in something, the more nervous we get about trusting that. And so this is just, it's part of everyday life. But no matter what someone says, how concrete they feel like their understanding of something is, there is just so much faith and assumptions in that. And it just helps us to, it's something that we can look for. Sometimes it seems like somebody has this really watertight argument on something, and then you realize it's only watertight if you accept the assumptions. And you start looking for them, and you say, wait a second, you're making this claim, underlying claim, that I cannot accept because there's not evidence for it. And it can be at a very simple thing, it can be at a very complex level. This is just something random I found online, a convincing experiment. Dr. Sabourat of the Pasteur Institute, Paris, France, inoculated a rabbit with human dandruff germs, and in between 5 and 6 weeks, says the official report of the Pasteur Institute, the rabbit was completely denuded, all its hair fell out. In fact, it had become entirely bald. This experiment proves that dandruff is a contagious disease due to the presence of microbic growth in the sebaceous glands of the scalp, and so forth, and then they're promoting their product. It's just an example. I don't know if that's reasonable or not, if this is even a real ad or somebody wrote it up for decoration. But just, it's an example of, you know, there's a lot of faith in all these things, whether it's snake oil or it's legitimate stuff. Okay, let's keep moving. Does it require faith? Supernaturalism, does that require faith? And if so, what? In what?
Supernaturalism would require faith in that you would need to believe that something beyond the physical is putting a greater force than nature on things.
Okay. What about naturalism? Is there faith required to believe, I'm not going to define every one of these terms, but that nature is all that there is? Yeah. It's fairly easy to say that if there is a supernatural world and it has no interaction with us, we have zero way of knowing that. That would be a blind faith in that supernatural world. But if there are things in our natural world that cannot be explained by the natural things that we observe, then we would then have some faith in a supernatural cause for it. But there is a naturalism has assumptions and faith, and sometimes those kind of are interchangeable. Christianity, does it require faith? Yes, it does. Okay, atheism does not believe in supernatural things, but does it believe something? Is there a faith statement? It believes that there is no God. Not that I don't believe that there is a God. That's maybe agnosticism. There might be faith associated with that. But atheism is a strong faith. It has a lot of faith required there, that there is no God. Creationism, yes, there's faith. Evolutionism, yes, there's faith. Young Earth, ancient Earth, all these things require faith to believe any viewpoint. And so don't get backed into a corner where somebody paints it like they don't rely on faith, but you do. Okay, are science and religion mutually exclusive? Depends on how you define them. If you define science as being exclusive of religion, then yes, it is, by that definition. But by the definition that we cited earlier, it isn't. The study of the natural world using evidences and so forth. I want to read a fair bit here from a scientist and his perspective on science and faith, and it's sounds just beautiful the way that he talks about it. And it's rather funny in a way. Just preceding the beginning of this quote, I forgot why I have more up there. This is what I want to have. He's going into through this real quick. I'm missing some slides that I had put together. I'll just have to read it off my screen here. But he's talking about the motion of the planets and all the complexity of everything involved. And he says, it is not to be conceived that mere mechanical causes could give birth to so many regular motions. So he's just looking at evidence. The motion of the planets, motion of the heavenly bodies is so complex that it's not conceivable that merely mechanical causes, merely physical causes could explain that. Since the comets range over all parts of the heavens in very eccentric orbits, for by that kind of motion they pass easily through the orbits of the planets. I believe what he's saying is you have comets passing through orbits of the planets, not through the planets themselves, they've already moved past, but they're going right through there. And why wouldn't they have collided at some point in the past? They're doing so with great rapidity, and their aphelions, where they move the slowest and are detained the longest, they recede to the greatest distance from each other. I don't understand all of this that he's talking about, but he's just describing the complexity of it and the unexpectedness of it. And thence suffer the least disturbance from their mutual attraction. So now we've got gravity and we've got how do these things interact. This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. That is a scientific statement. He's looking at the evidence and finding the most reasonable conclusion that explains what he observes. And if the fixed stars are the centers of other like systems, these, being formed by the likewise counsel, must be all subject to the dominion of one. So if the near universe that we observe is like the far universe that we observe, and the near universe is clearly governed by a master, then the far universe must be governed by a similar or the same master. And if they're the same, you would expect them to be the same master. This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, but as Lord over all. And on account of his dominion, he is wont to be called Lord God, or universal ruler. For God is a relative word. Relative meaning it has a relationship to other things. It has a respect to servants. And deity is the dominion of God, not over his own body, as those imagine who fancy God to be the soul of the world, but over servants. The supreme God is a being, eternal, infinite, absolutely perfect. But a being, however perfect, without dominion, cannot be said to be Lord God. So he said, the scientist sees a world that is beautiful, and he concludes that the one who makes it must be likewise perfect or beautiful. And also, he's drawing conclusions about the nature of this being, that it isn't the world like Mother Nature and some spirit that indwells that is all the stuff. It is one who governs everything, and he talks about how everything is in that one. It is the dominion of a spiritual being which constitutes a god, a true supreme or imaginary dominion, makes a true supreme or imaginary god. So a god is only as real as his dominion is. And from his true dominion it follows that the true God is a living, intelligent, and powerful being. These are still conclusions that you draw from observations in nature. And from his other perfections that he is supreme or most perfect. It is allowed by all, now we're up here, that the supreme God exists necessarily. That's a pretty bold statement in today's time. It is necessarily concluded that a supreme God exists. And by that same necessity, he exists always and everywhere. So not only is there a God, but we learn by necessity, we draw these necessary conclusions about the nature of this God, that he is ever-present, both in time and space. We have ideas of his attributes, but what the real substance of anything is, we know not. In bodies, just this is a body, this is a body, we see only their figures and colors. We hear only the sounds. We touch only their outward surfaces. We smell only the smells and taste the savors, but their inward substances are not to be known either by our senses or by any reflex act of our minds. So we can measure things, but what are they? What do they? What constitutes them? He's saying is something that we can't know. And since this scientist lived, so this is sometime in the past, we have learned more. We've found other ways to observe things, but still, can we truly know the very heart of it? But the main thing I want you to see here is how he arrives at these conclusions based on observations. Much less, then, have we any idea of the substance of God. And there's also a lot of philosophy in here, right? We know him only by his most wise and excellent contrivances of things and final causes. So we see the effects of this one Lord God who has dominion. We admire him for his perfections, but we reverence and adore him on account of his dominion. For we adore him as his servants, and a God without dominion, providence, and final causes is nothing else but fate and nature. So this scientist, who has a very high reputation among the scientific community, looks at fate, or random chance, and nature, the physical world without God, and says it has no dominion, it has no providence, it has no final causes. It is not the final cause of anything. It has its own cause. Blind metaphysical necessity, or time chance and the inherent properties of matter, we might say, which is certainly the same always and everywhere, could produce no variety of things. When we look around at this world, we see immense variety. But if a simple set, or even a complex set, but a universal set of laws governed everything, everything would be the same. If it was the Big Bang, everything would have exploded and been uniform, but it is not uniform in the least. And so he's saying that metaphysical necessity, laws of nature alone, cannot produce variety. They produce similarity. All that diversity of natural things which we find suited to different times and places. Not only is there diversity, there is purpose. This diversity is suited to different times. There's different seasons. There's different ecosystems and different locations. That could arise from nothing but the ideas and will of a being necessarily existing. Does anyone know who wrote this? Besides Wyatt. All right, Wyatt.
Okay.
Isaac Newton.
Does anyone know the name of the document that this is in? It's what's called the Principia. It is one of the greatest scientific writings ever. I was just looking at how do people refer to it. Britannica.com called it the foundation of modern science. If there is any question of whether science and religion conflict, we need to look at the foundation of science and see how much we can learn scientifically if we have a respect to the one who created nature. This is in a section called the Scholium, General Scholium. It was written in Latin originally, then translated. Not me. But, yeah, the Principia or the mathematical principles of natural philosophy. This is before they call it science. Natural philosophy. And this is just one of the greatest scientific treatises or books ever written. And what is funny is the next thing he starts talking about, he just goes right back into, and this is how gravity works and these things tie together. Like, it's not as though He took his religion, and he is a religious man, and put it over here, and then he had his science, and he had it over here. He goes from talking about the motion of the planets into this beautiful description of God, into gravity and how it interacts in this nerdy way. Like, it was all one and the same to him. and he was a great scientist. So that's something that we can point to. If there's a question of whether science and religion are opposed to each other, good science and good religion are not, if good religion is the truth. All right, what has God said about our modern challenge? We're going to cover what we can cover, and we're not going to pick it up next time. We've got more, a different topic to switch to a little bit. But one of the things that I noticed is that sometimes Scripture is, it seems old and is talking about things that are hard to relate to. I struggle in the Minor Prophets because there are a lot of historical context that I don't know. But then you read just the attitudes and things, and you're like, yeah, I get that. Sometimes Scripture, though, seems like it was written for us almost exclusively, like it hits the nail so accurately. And sometimes it's there, but it's surprising. So I just wanted to collect a few passages, and I will put them all up, and I'll send these slides out as well, that talk about things that are so relevant today. Psalm 14, verse 1 says, I don't have time to read it, so I'll hit the highlights, I guess. Fools say there is no God. But not only that, they are corrupted in their deeds. There's a connection between one who says there is no God and one who behaves like there is no God. But those with understanding seek God. Now, of course, we'd expect the Bible to say this, but it's good to hear it. Workers of wickedness do not have knowledge, and we've got to remember that when somebody has a lot of letters after their name. It doesn't mean that they have, it means they have a lot of knowledge in some area, but it may not mean that they have good knowledge of, or good conclusions from that. In spite of their power, the wicked's power, they are in terror, verse 5. Something else to remember. Somebody may be boisterous, but it might be because they're afraid. They're afraid of God. They're afraid of the truth. They're afraid that they'll be exposed. And this isn't everybody. Some people are just trying to find their way. But some people are like this. Those people would shame the poor or the afflicted, but the poor and the afflicted have refuge in the Lord. Psalm 2, verse 1 through 4. This is a messianic prophecy, but again, it speaks to today as well. The nations and the peoples rage against the Lord, but he says that's in vain. Now, this was against Christ and when he was crucified. But verse 3 was really telling to me that their underlying motivation was, we will throw off his chains. They fought against Jesus, not on some purely ideological basis that I have different conclusions than he is teaching. They didn't want God telling them what to do. And Jesus told them things they didn't like to hear about how they ought to be living. And that is why they didn't believe him. And that is a big motivator. I was looking for a quote that basically, and it was by an evolutionist, that said the reason we don't believe in God is because we don't want him interfering with our sex lives. That is why they don't believe. They don't want God's morals, and so they won't believe in him, which is, you can see how dishonest that is, but the honesty to say it is commendable, I suppose. But regardless of all this, the best efforts are laughable in the face of God who sits in heaven and laughable in the face of his anointed. He scoffs at them. Psalm 10, 4 through 6, 11 through 14, all the thoughts of the wicked are, there is no God. So they're constantly thinking about this. There's no God, and so if I'm prosperous, I'm untouchable. I've got tenure. I've got position in a company. I've got influence. The world is with me. So many reasons that someone who thinks there is no one above them can think they can't be touched. They think they can hide, that God can't see their deeds. And, of course, you start to act like that if you don't think you'll be held accountable. But God will hold them accountable and will deliver his people. Isaiah 29, 9 through 16, the key point here is in verse 16, shall the potter be considered as equal with the clay, that what is made would say to its maker, he did not make me. I mean, if that's not what we're dealing with today, it's just amazing how relevant that was to people who were dealing with other things that looked exactly the same way. Human nature hasn't changed. We just find different names to put on these things. He uses this again elsewhere in Isaiah. It talks in Isaiah 45, 7 through 12, talks about God's creative power and his creative work and points to his future work and says, are you going to call this into question? You need to look back and see what I've done in the past. This one was in the prophecy about Cyrus years before he was even born. And God's talking about, I'm going to do this thing. You look back at creation and see what's going to happen. See if I keep my word. We ought to regard God with praise. Psalm 148 is talking about all nature praising God and just enumerating all the different things and the people of the earth. The fear of God is the beginning of knowledge, Psalm 107. All right, next time we will talk about stealing from God and do so with some practice. We're going to look at an article and see, we're going to just kind of practice digesting it. See, looking for logical fallacies or just some bad conclusions, try to make it a little bit practical.